Welcome to the latest episode of the IA School of Thought series with me, Syed Kamal. I'm the Academic and Research Director at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Now, this series is based on the IA book, School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers by Amon Butler, which, as the title suggests, summarizes the thoughts of leading classical liberal thinkers on a range of issues and discusses them within a modern context. All the episodes in this series and all our other online content can be found on the IA YouTube channel, IA London, or on Podbean, or on our website, ia.org.uk. Today's featured thinker is economist and Nobel laureate Ronald Coase, known the world over for his theory of the firm. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Chento Veljanovski, who's an economist, IA fellow in law and economics, and the former research and editorial director at the IA, in effect. He's one of my predecessors. So, Chento, welcome back, and thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
So, can I start off by asking, why did you pick Ronald Coase? Was there anything particular that inspired you about him? Did he have a profound impact on you specifically, or did you admire the role he played in shaping our thinking?
Yes, he had a profound impact. As an undergraduate and a graduate in Australia, I came across his work, and because I was doing law and economics, I immediately saw that A, law did not have a theory or a framework in which you could discuss certainly the impact of the law, but certainly the coherence of it. And what he gave by analyzing various numbers of cases in a very important article he wrote, The Problem of Social Cost, he showed how economics could be used to analyze the law, but also that the law had a more profound understanding of some of the economic issues than economists had. And so my first article I ever published in the Economic Record was in 1977, which emerged, and I wasn't aware at the time, as one of the first debates outside the United States about the so-called Coase theorem and its validity. And my whole career has basically been focused on the application of economics to law, and it's been greatly influenced by Coase and his work and those who followed him.
And was he unique in addressing that particular issue about the economics of law, or were there many other contemporaries around the same time?
Well, what was unique about Coase is he wasn't that interested in, I suppose, the law itself. He was using that as a way of saying that economists should look at institutions. So he was, in some sense, harking back to the old-style political economy, where you looked at economics in its legal and political context. But he was really trying to address what he saw as a flaw in the economist market failure approach. He was trying to get to get economists to look at real world problems rather than benchmarking the real world against the competitive market model and market failure. And his basic contribution to the core of economics was to say that given the assumptions of the perfectly competitive market model, which economists were using, there couldn't be market failure. Market failure was the result of transaction costs. And you might want to look at why real-world institutions developed, such as the firm and the various other organizations, and why laws are framed in the way they are. And he attributed that to the existence of transaction costs. The laws, the firm, were institutional devices designed to economize on transaction costs. So that was his major contribution. And it was picked up by lawyers because they suddenly saw that you could use economics to analyze legal cases, and they developed that. And I believe that the problem of social costs is the most cited article in legal scholarship, but not so that much in economics, oddly enough. And we might come at what were the successes and failures of Coase's work. But that was his major contribution. He wanted to change economists' thinking about market failure and government regulation.
So when we look back at his work now, you know, there are clearly two pieces of work that stand out, and you've mentioned them. One is The Nature of a Firm from 1937, where he showed about how the structure of firms depended on transaction costs, and the 1960 publication, The Problem of Social Cost, where he outlined the theorem that there could be no market failure in perfectly competitive markets. Was he someone who struggled to have his ideas adopted or listened to at the time, only to be vindicated later? Or did he have an immediate impact with both those works?
No, he didn't have an immediate impact. And I think later in his life, he expressed regret that he hadn't had enough impact on economists. He had a major impact on law because the law and economics movement, or the economic analysis of law, flourished, particularly in North America. And now there's probably no law school in the United States that doesn't have a professor of economics on the law faculty. So I think he was disappointed in the impact that he made, because as far as economists were concerned, with regard to the problem of social costs, which gave rise to the Coase theorem, it was viewed as very much a sort of market manifesto, and, you know, we're all in the best of all possible worlds because any apparent failure was the result of transaction costs. And so he wasn't really picked up by economists that much as by lawyers and economists working in law schools. And there was a huge controversy over the problem of social costs as it developed. And I think he stayed out of the controversy, but he eventually discussed it and tried to set the record straight. But it just took off on the various tangents of focus on the Coase theorem, rather than his more sort of practical advice, is that you have to look at real world institutions and you have to compare what's now known as a comparative institutional approach. You have to compare one reality with another, rather than benchmarking things against competitive market model, which he described as sort of blackboard economics. It wasn't, oddly enough, that interested in some areas that you would have thought he would have had a major impact. When he was at Chicago, he was a professor of law and economics at Chicago in the law school. He taught antitrust law, but he advised economists to stay away from it, oddly enough, even though Chicago had a major impact on the development of antitrust, because he said the economists would become too influenced by being what he called economic statesmen, wanting to say something to lawyers about what, you know, is the optimal policy or what policies they should adopt. So he was, in that sense, he was quite a purist. He said, and you mentioned the two articles, The Theory of the Firm and The Social Cost. These are two articles 30 years apart, which basically focus on the same concept of transaction costs. And he got the Nobel Prize for that. So there's a lesson for young budding economists is, you know, write less, think more, and wait three to six decades to get a Nobel Prize. But oddly enough, the problem of social costs was preceded by an analysis of the Federal Communication Commission. And if there's one single success you could point to Ronald Coase, is that he, in that article, he was talking about the allocation of radio spectrum. And he said, radio spectrum traditionally had been allocated by administrative criteria and by government, and a lot of it was warehoused by the military and security forces. And he said, well, he was commissioned by the RAND Corporation with a couple of other economists to look in how to get a more efficient allocation of radio spectrum, because it was wastefully allocated. And he suggested creating a market or an auction system to sell spectrum. And he was heavily criticized. In fact, RAND tried to withdraw their support for the report. And they described it as he was advocating corruption to sell spectrum. It was a corrupt idea. But, you know, two decades ago, it was picked up by governments. It's a major success policy. And he was really one of the few who initially suggested a market allocation approach to spectrum, which has now been adopted. So his practical success has been in a spectrum allocation policy.
Now, you mentioned two decades ago. Interestingly enough, two decades ago is when I began my academic career post just after my PhD, and the area I taught in was the area of international business. And every undergraduate lecture I taught has a few slides about the theory of the firm and co. So clearly by then, he had become hugely influential across the political spectrum in the theory of the firm and in academia. So he clearly was influential there. But how influential do you think he has been in shaping the sort of the whole classical liberal narrative and that contribution to economics and politics as well?
Yeah. Well, one thing I'll append to what you've just said, he's been quite successful in business schools because, you know, they're looking at very detailed analysis of business strategy. So a lot of the economists working in the area who have adopted a Coasean approach come from the business school or law schools, but not from mainstream economics. You pick up an economics textbook and you'll see some reference to the Coase theorem and probably some suggestion that, you know, that's a theoretical proposition. How influential has he been? As I said, he was disappointed that he hadn't had an impact on mainstream economics because he's also quite well known for other areas that he got involved, which was the marginal cost controversy in particular, and then the monopoly in durable goods. And he's actually associated with two theorems, the Coase conjecture in industrial economics. But I think if I look, say, at the area of industrial economics or antitrust, he doesn't seem to have had that much impact overall. He's had an impact in a more indirect way of people recognizing government failure, the need to take into account the costs of government compared to the costs of the market. But I think as the research director of the IA, you will appreciate that the market failure process is very pervasive and used routinely to say, well, look, you know, the market fails, we've got to have some intervention, and not really analyzing what the intervention is. I mean, I'm just doing some work on algorithms and digital antitrust, and they're all talking about the problems of Google and Facebook and various other digital platforms, and it's all compared, you know, the failure in the digital sector is compared with ideal regulation that's going to come in and stop it. So, you know, bad behavior by digital platforms is compared to smart regulation. So it's this comparative institutions approach, I think, that was been fostered by Demsetz and Oliver Williamson that has probably been the major intellectual impact. And people like Ostrom and other institutional economists have picked that up. And you know, to be totally objective about it, that sort of swathe of institutional economists, Ostrom, Williamson, Coase, of course, and Douglas North, all those institutional economists did get Nobel Prizes in the end because they had a fundamental insight that you have to look at property rights institutions to understand the way the economy is developing and what are the pros and cons of various alternatives. So it's had an indirect impact. But I think if you mention Ronald Coase to people now, they'd know the Coase theorem if they were doing an undergraduate degree. But I don't think they'd say, well, this is the core of our arsenal to look at economic problems, rightly or wrongly. But that's my feeling, because law and economics petered out in the UK. It's still it's got quite popular on continental Europe. But again, it's a different style of law and economics that's developed, which is more mathematical, more empirical. He was quite anti, you know, treating humans as rational human beings. He was concerned with choice, with studying institutions and others to understand their economic impact rather than trying to apply economics to analyze institutions. And so he sort of started to separate himself, for example, from the Chicago Economic Analysis of Law. And I think they were quite a loggerheads at some periods in their professional careers.
So Eamon Butler says in the book, in his little bit about Ronald Coase, he says that he was influential in addressing the solution to market failure, not necessarily being government intervention or regulation, but to clarify property rights in order to cut transaction costs and to enable market solutions to emerge. And he talks about how this hugely influenced debates on environmental issues and clearly informed the work of Eleanor Ostrom on managing common pool resources. So we know about he clearly has an influence in many ways, not only in his own field of theory of the firm or how he's better known, but with classical liberals and common pool resources. But do we know much about who influenced him and his ideas?
Yes, I mean, in the book that we, the IEA, published some years ago, which was a sort of commemorative volume of Ronald Coase's life, it was just published after he died, and he lived for a long, long time. He was 103 when he left us. As you may, mentioned he was at the LSC. He was doing industrial relations type course, and he says himself that had he not met Arnold Plant, who was at the LSC, who changed his view about markets, because I think Coase originally was sort of on the left side of thinking at the time, and he got a sort of grant or a scholarship to go study firms in the United States, and that's where he developed this notion of transaction costs. And so he developed the notion in basically as an undergraduate, and then worked it up into an article some years later. And so he started to change track from, as he says himself, he would have become a lawyer, an industrial labor lawyer, as we call them today. But he was influenced by the thinking of Arnold Plant, the LSC, and a lot of his economics was really the LSC type of concept of costs, which are subjective opportunity costs. So when you see economic models in books, they say C is the cost. And normally when they try to test it, they will look at the accounting costs or some adjustment to accounting costs. But what he had and what drove the Coase in was the concept of opportunity cost. The cost of something is what you give up in order to get it. And that links the concept of cost to resource allocation, because you're, and how markets work, they're constantly comparing what is the best place to allocate resources, and that requires an opportunity cost notion of cost. He then, after the war, he became disillusioned with the what was happening in the United Kingdom on the path to socialism. So he left and took up professorships at American universities. And I think he was at Buffalo originally, then went to Virginia, and then was approached by the University of Chicago really to set up the Journal of Law and Economics, which was also one of his great contributions, because that provided an outlet for law and economics research. And he did more than just be the editor. He basically encouraged research, commented extensively on the articles, and mentored people, as we say today. And that was another success story of Ronald Coase, and of course the law and economics movement. So I don't think he basically made his life in the United States and the environment there more conducive. But he was an outsider, a fully paid up member of the Awkward Squad, because I think one of the lessons one learns from Coase is don't believe other economists. You know, if you think you're on the right track, stick with it, even though you're going to get a lot of flack from like-minded fellow travellers in the process. So he was quite consistent, and I think intellectually he was probably a hard man to deal with, in the sense that he had his views and he fostered them, and good on him. It was a success story, but you know, it had some ups and downs.
Well, you talk about where, you know, if you have your particular views, you know, be aware of, or don't listen to those who necessarily disagree with you. But why do you look at that, about this area of disagreement? You know, if you think about the sort of people who are, you know, are fans of the IA and the work we do, the classical liberals across the spectrum, you know, we all know that classical liberals don't have one view. Yeah. You can put two in a room and get three different views. Where do you think classical liberals today might disagree with some of his conclusions?
It's a good question. I don't know that there would be a lot of agreement. I don't think he would see himself necessarily in that sort of camp, because he was probably what you call an economist. He was interested in what the real world told us about economics, and that we should focus on studying the real world to better understand the economy and economic behavior. So I think his scope was narrow. I don't recall an article by him that overarched into his policy or philosophy. And I can give you quotes from him warning people to stay away from, you know, practical legal analysis, such as antitrust and becoming experts in antitrust cases, because it would colour the way they saw things. So, but he was a, you know, if, I hate to use the term, but let's say classical liberal in the sense that he believed in markets, he believed in the efficiency of markets, he was sceptical about government, and he felt that a lot of economists were analysing situations from this theoretical point of view, when in fact, when you looked at the facts more closely, you could identify that there were reasons, transaction cost reasons, why it was done in this particular way. For example, I think a number of economists used the Fisher-Body case of showing the monopolization of the car body industry and saying it was due to significant transaction costs and opportunism and market power that this Fisher-Body, the main car bodies for a big manufacturer, was taken over. But he said, when you look at the facts, this wasn't the case. And, you know, we can see a number of examples, such as in the market failure literature, the Lighthouse, the fable of the bees and all that, that people are saying, well, that's market failure. And then people like Chung and Peacock look more carefully and show that, you know, lighthouses were privately provided, you know, apiarists and orchardists came to agreements in some counties in the United States because they realized they were providing reciprocal externalities to each other, and so they had commercial relationships to take account of that. In that sense, he was cautious about leaping immediately to the government regulation box to solve the problem. He said a lot of these problems are not problems. They've been solved by the marketplace, and we've got to study them in much more detail.
Well, his ideas on transaction costs are still very much in vogue today. In fact, we have a forthcoming book at the IAA from Michael Munger on the sharing economy. And Michael Munger writes in that book that he shows how how technology lowers transaction costs, which allows many of the companies like Uber and Airbnb to emerge. Do you think Coase would have felt that his work had been vindicated by the sharing economy?
Well, the transaction cost approach started to get very developed by Oliver Williamson, and I think towards the end of his career, I think he was a member, founding member of the New Institutionalist or New Institutional movement, of which Oliver Williamson was a major proponent, who also got a Nobel Prize. And yes, he would see that. He would say, you know, technology or devices that lower transaction costs lead to the development of new services and doing things better. And of course, Munger did contribute to this book too. So this is the progenitor of his ideas about what he's developing into a full-scale paperback now.
Well, Chinto, I'm speaking to you in the middle of a pandemic, maybe not the middle, but somewhere in the middle. You know, we're entering, I think, week 16 next week. Are there lessons from Coase's work for how governments should deal with the pandemic, or are there any lessons, or am I just looking for tenuous links where there are none?
Yes, it's a good question. I don't think he was thinking about pandemics when he was writing his various approaches, but I think he would be looking, first of all, at cooperative relationships and voluntary relationships to deal with pandemics. And like most economists, he would be saying, well, are these government interventions targeted at the real problem? And, you know, I don't think he would have any ready-made answers to that. And I would be very surprised if he even probably would be willing to have commented on it, because it was outside the province of what he was typically focused on, which was what we now call institutional or industrial economics. It was his forte. But it would be Well, I've read most of his work and I don't recall anything about pandemics.
Of course, well, I don't think you're predicting it.
But I suppose everything's about pandemics at the moment or digital.
Yeah. So, and do we know much about him as a person? I mean, was he a family man? You know, did he share his work with his family or was it very private? You know,
I don't really know. I didn't know him at a personal level. Some of our colleagues knew him much better, like Stephen Littlechild, but I don't know. I mean, he lived to a very old age. I don't think I can answer what he was like as a person. I mean, one of the big anecdotes that is mentioned in Forever Contemporary, the book we did on Coase, and has done the rounds many times, is how he persuaded the whole Department of Economics at Chicago that he was right, because initially, in social costs, they said, you're wrong. That's just incorrect. So Aaron, director, invited them over for an afternoon drink, basically. The whole economics department was there. And he had, I think, probably only one economist agreed with him to start off. And by the end of the night, he had the whole faculty, 20-odd economists, agreeing that he was correct. And he would say that it was just common sense and quite simple economics that he was putting forward. It was just common sense to him that was right. Whether you make a train liable for the damages it does or not liable, the zero transaction costs, the farmers and the train company will negotiate to get the optimal amount of sparks and damage to crops. That was one of the examples he's used, the fire-emitting train. And it all rested on really the LSE concept of opportunity and subjective costs, and one action is measured, the cost of one action is measured in terms of what you give up to undertake that action. So, yeah, pandemics, I don't know.
Okay, well, Chento, we've had a fascinating conversation about Ronald Coase. In summing up, you know, you clearly are an admirer, you've been influenced by him. If someone said to me, come on, Chento, tell me about Ronald Coase in a few sentences, why should I be so interested in this work? What would you say in a couple of sentences?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that he fundamentally changed a whole area of scholarship, or created not only one area of scholarship, but several areas of scholarship: law and economics, economic analysis of law, which is more of a law, and he greatly influenced legal scholarship. There's no doubt about that. And secondly, he cautions economists not to immediately jump to the government regulation box when there is a perceived market failure, that the competitive market model is useful as a heuristic device, but is not useful as a way of thinking about the economy, because there's no perfectly competitive markets, there's no perfect regulation, and there's a choice between the two, and where the boundary lies can only be understood by a careful analysis. And so I think there are his two messages. You've got to compare realistic alternatives, and you've got to do your homework in terms of understanding fully what the institutions are actually doing. And I suppose, in a nutshell, he says, what happens is reality will always make good theory. You might have to look at it that way. But I think that's his contribution.
Well, that's a lovely note to end on. Dr. Chento Veljanovski, thank you very much for joining us for School of Thought, 101 Liberal Thinkers. And to your viewers, and listeners, thank you very much for joining us. If you would like more information on our publications, our webinars, and our other online content, please check out our YouTube channel, IA London, and listen to our podcasts on Podbean. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at ia.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening today, and we hope that you'll be able to join us again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.